Well, greetings, everyone. I'm George Gordon. Gather around, let me tell you the story about the law. These discs now take the place of my general law tape. And there are about as many opinions about this thing called law as there are people to opine about it. If any one of those opinions were true, then all of the rest would have to be false, wouldn't they? Now, confusion abounds, and the blind lead the blind, and they all fall in the ditch. Now, I teach law here at the Gordon Law School. I teach pro se litigation to people just like you, Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife. Housewives, doctors, dentists, truck drivers, plumbers, carpenters, electricians, businessmen all come to school here, and they all have one thing in common, and that is they're all subject to the law. And we're all involved in the law, whether we like it or not. And that's because we all have driver's licenses that bind us to thousands of traffic rules and regulations. Most people don't know how many traffic laws and regulations there are in their code, but they have a driver's license for which they have voluntarily agreed with the state that they will obey them all. We have business licenses that bind us to the Uniform Business and Professions Code. The average businessman or professional wouldn't have a clue as to where to find that code with both hands at high noon and a map. We have marriage licenses that subject us to the Department of Family Services, the Welfare Department, child support laws, but we don't understand those laws, we don't know what those laws are, and those laws are being added to by the legislature every session, but you don't know anything about them. And government prosecutes all of us for any violation of these laws. And the question arises, well then, how do we cope? How do we defend? Well, I've developed 8 schools to teach citizens, just local Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives, the average run-of-the-mill carpenter, plumber, electrician, the blue-collar workers, and the professionals. So whether you're a professional or a blue-collar worker, the law affects you just like it does me. And the question arises, how do we defend? The 8 schools are tax and status, courtroom strategy and procedure, my private business school, civil rights, subsistence and survival, how to make $100,000 a year on 25 acres or less, family law, and the Mosaic Law School, the law that everyone believes is abolished, repealed, nullified, archaic, harsh, done away with, and nailed to the cross with Jesus. Well, let's start with the income tax. Well, it's not over till it's over on April the 15th. You know, if you stop, for example, to buy a pizza on a Thursday night to celebrate being done with the IRS for another year, the tax man will be right there to grab a slice or two of that pizza. On top of paying the sales tax, you will also be picking up a major chunk of what the government charges or taxes that pizza store owner for local property taxes, unemployment insurance taxes, federal payroll taxes, federal and state and local income taxes, and workers' compensation insurance. Altogether, according to a study by the Americans for Tax Reform, that comes to $3.80 on a $10 pizza. Think of that. 38% of the price of that pizza is tax. Now, if you pick up a Bud six-pack to go with the pizza, there's another 43 cents of each beer dollar that goes straight to the tax man to pay the excise tax, income tax, property taxes, and so on. For something a little stronger, let's say you want to drink some Jack Daniels or Wild Turkey, then the tax man's share is $7.20 on average out of every $10 bill that you spend on booze. Now, that's 72%. What does the government do to produce that bottle or that fifth of Jack Daniels for which the government ought to be paid 72 cents. Now go a little lighter and just drink, say, Pepsi-Cola. That's 35% of what you pay for that Pepsi-Cola goes to taxes at all levels. Now add some Marlboros and it's 75% on a pack of cigarettes. That's right, 75% of the retail price that's funneled directly into the state's coffers. Now, get home and hit the light switch, and another 26% or $26 out of every $100 bill that you spend on electricity goes to the government rather than for or to the production of electricity. Now, if you're up and flying the next day, the tax man is up early and waiting at the airport for you, and the government pockets $40 on every $100 bill that you spend on an airline ticket. And he's there in the hotel lobby when you land, snatching 43%, $43 of every $100 that you spend in the hotel goes to tax. When you go out to dinner, it's another 28%. That's $28 out of every $100 bill of the tab that ends up with the government rather than with the restaurant. You know, the restaurant, the farmers, the truckers, and everyone else who work together to produce the meal make less than $28 out of every $100 bill that you spend. The people who actually produce that meal don't get as much as the government does, and the government does absolutely nothing to prepare it. Now, at each and every stop, in items large and small, the greedy hand of government has its sticky fingers in every pocket with bread. A recent study by Pricewaterhouse shows that there are 30 different taxes imposed on the production and sale of something as common as a loaf of bread. And it accounts for 27% of the average retail price. So more than a quarter of the price of the bread is in tax. Now buy some tires. That's 36%. $36 out of every 100 goes to the tax man on a set of tires. Now, on the price of a new car, an Americans for Tax Reform study shows that the total tax reaches 45% of the showroom sticker price. 45% of the sticker price is taxed. Add some gas, and 54% of what you pay for a fill-up goes for 43 different federal, state, and local taxes rather than to the oil producer, the retailer, or anybody in between who actually drills the oil well, produces the oil, ships it, refines it, produces it, delivers it, and pumps it into your tank. Now, at the start of our nation's unique experiment with individual sovereignty and limited government, taxation without representation was called tyranny. That was the watchword of the American Revolution. For our founding fathers, a level of taxation of only a few cents on a dollar siphoned off to a faraway and arrogant bureaucracy in England was enough to ignite a revolution, enough to grab the trusty musket off the wall. Today, in contrast, if we dare to startle the more panicky among us by buying a good rabbit gun, the government's there at the cash register to check our papers and then seize $46 of every $100, 46% of the price of that gun goes to taxes. And all of this, of course, this immense pile of hidden taxation is stacked on top of our local property taxes and our local, state, and federal income taxes. Is there a way out? Well, not so easy. Let's suppose that you act up and phone the IRS bureaucrat in Washington, D.C., and you complain about our out-of-control government, and the tax man grabs another $1. That's 50% of every $2. That's a dollar out of every two. 50% of what you spend on your telephone bill goes to taxes. Then if you get discouraged and get drunk, it's another 43 or 72% out of every dollar that you spend that gets siphoned off to the state, depending on whether it's Coors or Wild Turkey. For the average family, all of these taxes now eat up 38% of your total gross income. 38% of your gross income. Now, that's a higher rate of taxation than ever before in the peacetime history of the United States. Now, if you'll think about it, 38% of your gross. You don't have a dime to spend until after you have paid 33% of your gross to income tax and Social Security, because the Social Security tax takes 15.3 to 16.1% right off the top, for which then the lowest tax bracket is 17%. That's 17 to 45%. Then you get to pay your property taxes and gasoline taxes and all the rest of the taxes, of which there are 14 taxes that you pay that consume approximately 75% of everything you create and produce. Well, we're now at the absurd point where the typical family works until noon of every working day to satisfy the tax man, paying more in taxes than you spend on food, clothing, and housing combined. So you know there's three things that you have to live. That's food, clothing, and shelter. You're now spending more on taxes than you do on the basic necessities of life. Now today, with 480 different tax forms, 17,000 pages of laws and regulations, and a federal tax code that's more than 7 million words, compared to only 773,000 words in the Bible. That's right, 773,000 words, and that's in both the Old and New Testament, compared to 7 million words, just in your federal tax code. That doesn't include your state or your local tax codes. Nearly 60% of Americans are paying a professional to help them negotiate this tax maze. And every year, the IRS sends out 8 billion pages of forms and instructions, enough paper to stretch 28 times around the earth to conform with this federal Rube Goldberg tax code. Americans are spending 5.4 billion hours and $200 billion a year just in compliance costs. Not counting the taxes paid, just the compliance cost is $200 billion a year. Now, to give you an illustration, how much money is $200 billion a year? Well, it's more time and money than it takes to produce every car, every truck, and every van every year in the United States. That's right. If you took the entire automobile industry, we spend more money on just income tax compliance than the entire auto industry. Isn't that just special? Now, when this federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied on only the super wealthy. It was the richest one-half of 1% of the population, with a top tax rate of about 7%. Today, of course, the fears of these early opponents of the tax have been more than fully realized. By the end of Herbert Hoover's term, the top tax rate had jumped to 60%. By the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top tax rate was over 90%, and the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. In 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th before earning enough to satisfy the tax man at all levels. And this year, the average American family will work all the way through until May 12th in order to earn enough to pay their federal, state, and local tax bills. May 12th. That's called Tax Freedom Day. You ever heard that term, Tax Freedom Day? Back in 1932, in the Idaho Supreme Court, they made a pretty startling statement here. This comes from Diefendorf versus Galea. Let me tell you a little story here about the income tax from the Supreme Court of Idaho. And they kind of tell us a little piece of the story. Because in the tax protest movement or the Patriot movement, you oftentimes hear the term or the statement made that the tax code does not tell us what the income tax is. Nowhere in the tax code is there a definition of income tax. Well, that's not true. The tax code does have the definition of the income tax contained in it. But most people who are not trained in law can't find it. So let me point it out to you. Here in the Idaho State Tax Code, the Supreme Court, in a case called Idaho, this is Diefendorf versus Galea, this is the Idaho Supreme Court, they said income is defined as, all right, now get your pen and paper out, sharpen your pencil on both ends, because here comes the definition for income. In case you've always wondered, what is it? I'm going to tell you. Income is defined as something. Write that down. S-O-M-E-T-H-I-N-G. You got it right straight out of the Supreme Court of Idaho. Income is something. And whatever this something is, it is derived from property. Got that? I knew you'd love it. Income is defined as something derived from property, labor, skill, ingenuity, or sound judgment, or from two or more in combination. Cited in Stony Brook Rail Corporation versus Boston and Maine Railroad Company. 260 Massachusetts, 379. So the Idaho Supreme Court cited it from the Massachusetts Supreme Court. Now, the income tax has been around for a long time. You see that in Schaefer versus Carter. Now, the very first income tax imposed in the United States was in New York State in 1778. Did you get that? Write it down. 1778, New York State, first income tax. That's just 2 years after the Declaration of Independence. Now, the same meaning, this court goes on to say, appears to have attached to the term property in all subsequent taxing legislation and in the taxing practices of the executives, and we take judicial notice. Judicial notice. That means you don't have to come in here and prove this. We take judicial notice. It's common knowledge in law that income as such has never been assessed or taxed as property in the state of Idaho. Common knowledge. Common practice. Courts take judicial notice that income has never been assessed or taxed as property. Income is not property. Now, here's an interesting concept. Did you know that property has never been assessed or taxed in the United States of America under our Constitution? That's right. See, property is a right. Rights can't be taxed. Ah, so there's something about this income. Did you know that income is called an excise tax? Just two kinds of taxes, two types of taxes. Under our Constitution, we have two taxes. It's direct and indirect. Isn't that amazing? That's easy to learn. Direct and indirect. It's almost like up and down, left and right, direct and indirect. Well, a direct tax is where we come to everybody and we say everybody pays $2. That's a direct tax. But an indirect tax is a tax where, like gasoline, we go in and buy a gallon of gasoline for $1.25, and there's 43 taxes on that, but you don't know what those taxes are. Those are called hidden taxes. Somebody else paid the tax, and then he just passed it on in the cost of goods sold. Now, on page 633 of Diefendorf versus Galea, listen to this. This is a real neat statement. It says, income is necessarily the product of the joint efforts of the state and the recipient of the income. The state furnishing the protection necessary to enable the recipient to produce, receive, and enjoy it, and a tax thereon in the last analysis is simply a portion cut from the income and appropriated by the state as its share thereof. Isn't that real special? Listen to this again. Sharpen your pencil. Listen up. Income is necessarily the product of the joint efforts of the state and the recipient of the income. Now, what is it when we have a joint effort? You know, if you and I were working together in a joint effort, what would we call that? It's called a partnership. So income is necessarily the product of the partnership of the state and the recipient of the income. You, Joe Sixpack, receive an income. And this income is not property, because if it was property, Joe, we couldn't tax it. So whatever it is that you're doing to create and produce this income, it isn't property, and you have no property right in this income. Now, you know, in olden days, we didn't make income, we made increase, and we paid a tithe on our increase, which was property. Today, we pay a tax. We pay a tax on our income, which is not property. It's an excise privilege that we receive from government. Now, we have converted then our right to property to an excise privilege. Here's the next statement, or the next sentence. It says, the state furnishes the protection necessary to enable the recipient to produce, receive, and enjoy it. So the state, one of your two partners here in this limited general partnership, furnishes the protection necessary protection. What kind of protection did you need, Joe? Oh, you need an unemployment insurance workman's compensation and 108 benefits under the Social Security program called the safety net. Remember, George Bush said, what Americans want are jobs, 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 and we have to have a safety net. Well, gee, Joe, you got to pay for the safety net, don't you? And so we pay an income tax, which is an excise tax on a joint venture, a partnership between you and the state, and the state furnishes the protection, the insurance, the limited liability necessary to enable you, Joe, the recipient, to produce, receive, and enjoy this income. Isn't that just real special? The state makes it possible for you to produce, receive, and enjoy this income. Not property, income. A franchise. So the tax, this income tax, thereon, in the last analysis, is simply a portion cut from the income and appropriated by the state as its share thereof. Hey, you know, you got a partner, and your partner, he produces something in this partnership to enable you to make this income. And so the state comes along and says, gee, Joe, shouldn't you pay me a portion? So if you're wondering why the state takes, in some cases, 72%, 43%, 45%, 38%, the state is just taking its share of a partnership agreement. Now, I know you're probably sitting there saying, well, why, I never made any agreement with the government. Well, you didn't make any agreement that you knew about, but you have an agreement. You have a partnership. You have a contract. In fact, you have a contract in writing. Yeah, that's right. It's in writing, a written contract. It's called Social Security. Social Security. Now, listen to this. In labor and labor relations, cited from 48 American Jurisprudence, second edition, section 1, I'm on page 80. In labor laws, the term labor may be used in a comprehensive sense as including those who toil with their brains as well as those performing manual work. So whether you're working as an insurance salesman or agent, or whether you're digging ditches or driving a truck, in labor laws, the term labor may be used in a comprehensive sense as including those who toil with their brains as well as those performing manual work. So if you're working at a bank, that's called labor. Now, the constitutional protection of your right to work is in Section 2, when it says the right to labor and to its protection from unlawful interference is a constitutional as well as a common law right. Every man has a natural right to the fruits of his own industry. Isn't that kind of neat? So the right to labor and to its protection from unlawful interference is a constitutional as well as a common law right. The common law goes clear back to Moses at Mount Sinai, and a constitutional right goes back to 1787. And every man, and that includes you ladies too, and every woman, has a natural right to the fruits of your own industry. What you create and produce is yours. You've got a right to it, 100% of it. Isn't that kind of neat? Now, you go to work for General Motors, and they pay you $10 an hour. You work for 40 hours, and at the end of the week, they give you a check for $400, right? Well, dream on, because you're going to get a check for about $310. They're going to take $90 out and send it to your partner. And in some cases, partners, you know, like the labor union, they get a share called dues. And then, of course, the Social Security Administration, they're a partner, and so they get a cut, 16.1%. And then, of course, there's the government, the income tax, and they get a cut of it. And then there's a bunch of other taxes over here that you're paying for that you contracted for. Isn't that kind of neat? Now, labor is deemed to be property. Property has never been assessed or taxed in the United States. Labor is deemed to be property. Somebody said to me one time, well, they're taxing my labor. Oh, no, no. No, sir, government doesn't tax your labor. That's against the law. Now, picture this. You go to work at General Motors. You work there 40 hours. That's labor. At the end of the week, they give you $400, less 90. So you get net 310, and your partners take 90. And you say they're taxing my labor. No, they're not. They're taxing the dollars. They're taxing the unjust weights and balances that are prohibited in Leviticus 19, 35 and 36, and Deuteronomy 25. Oh, I guess it's about 13 through 16. All right, so let's picture this and understand it. You see, God comes along and he says, I want you to practice strict liability. And we came along and said, God, you dum-dum, you don't understand international high finance. We need to practice limited liability with insurance. And in order for us to do that, we have to have commercial paper. So God comes along and says, now I want you to use gold and silver coin called just weights and balances and deal in property instead of commercial paper. And we said, God, you just don't understand. We have to fix your mistake. Now, we understand that you're kind of old-fashioned and you made these laws 3,100 years ago, not understanding the modern American economy. So we have to have insurance. We have to have unemployment insurance, workman's compensation, and a whole host and plethora of other limited liabilities that are furnished by government. In order to finance this, we have to have commercial paper like mortgages, bonds, stocks, Federal Reserve notes. And in order for us to have all of this, we then have to have taxes in order to support and pay for this government, which oversees all of this limited liability, and the tax is on the dollars, not on your labor. And you see, you went in and signed a Social Security agreement. When you got your Social Security card, you agreed Under the terms of the contract called the Social Security Act of 1935, codified at Title 42, Section 301 through 335. There's the contract. See, most of you couldn't have found that contract at high noon with both hands and a roadmap, but now I just told you where it's at. Now you can go find it. You should read your contract, because that's the contract that takes 16.1% of everything you create and produce. And do you know that you couldn't pay an income tax without a Social Security number? Because that's your taxpayer identification number. Did you know that? Oh, yeah, I'll show you that here in a couple of minutes. So labor is deemed to be property, but you don't have any property in your labor because you contracted it away. And this is especially true within the meaning of the constitutional guarantees, but of course your constitutional guarantees give way to your right to contract. So go to Article 1, Section 2, and you'll see that government is prohibited from interfering or impairing your right to contract. So you have a right to contract with Social Security, the government, or anybody else, and you can give away your rights. So the right to acquire property, then, includes the right to acquire property by labor. So you have a right to labor and to acquire property by labor. Why did you contract that right away? Why did you give it up? Well, for the same reason that people join the Army. So you have a right to liberty, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and then you go down and sign an enlistment contract with the Army and impair your liberty for 2, 4, or 6 years. Well, it isn't that you can't. I mean, everybody has a right to enslave himself if he so desires. In fact, a free man must have the capacity to enslave himself, because if he didn't have that capacity, he wouldn't be free. Ah. So the right to earn wages is just as much property and within the protection of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to the Federal Constitution as are earned wages. So the fact that you're earning wages here at General Motors doesn't preclude you from the Bill of Rights and your right to earn wages, and your wages are property, unless or until you contract them away. Now, I would suspect that most of you people listening to me right now have a Social Security number, so you need to pay your income tax. Somebody's going to say, well, my God, you have to have a Social Security number, you couldn't get a job. Oh, no, that's not true. You can work anywhere you want without a Social Security number. Now, your employer told you you had to have a Social Security number, but you never litigated that, now, did you? Since the right to labor is protected by the 14th Amendment and numerous guarantees of state constitutions, one cannot be deprived of such right by arbitrary mandate of the legislature, and it merits legal protection. Congress could not enact a compulsory Social Security Act. Social Security isn't compulsory. It's voluntary. And it merits legal protection. Such right is likewise embraced by the 5th Amendment to the Federal Constitution. I don't have a Social Security number. I don't pay the income tax. I don't pay Social Security. But then I don't have any right to Social Security benefits. Now, isn't that just a drag? Now, listen to this. In Hale versus Hinkle, cited at 201 U.S. 43, back in 1905, conceding that the witness was an officer of the corporation under investigation and that he was entitled to assert the rights of the corporation with respect to the production of its books and papers, we're of the opinion that there is a clear distinction in this particular between an individual and a corporation, and that the latter has no right to refuse to submit its books and papers for an examination at the suit of the state. The individual may stand upon his constitutional rights as a citizen. He is entitled to carry on his private business in his own way. You, the individual, has power to contract, and it's unlimited. You, the individual, owe no duty to the state or to his neighbors to divulge his business or open his doors to an investigation. You, the individual, you owe no duty to the state, since you receive nothing therefrom. Yet underline, you receive nothing therefrom. You see, everybody in America receives some benefit from government, and government is right there, Johnny, on the spot to offer you all of these benefits. Benefits. And the individual's rights are such as existed by the law of the land. That's called the common law, the law of the land, long antecedent to the organization of the state, and can only be taken from him by due process of law and in accordance with the Constitution. Now, on the other hand, the corporation, and when you get a Social Security number, you join this corporate capacity. And on the other hand, the corporation is a creature of the state, and it's presumed to be incorporated for the benefit of the public. So Joe, working at General Motors, is presumed to be for the benefit of the public, and you, Joe, receive certain special privileges and franchises, and you hold those subject to the laws of the state and the limitations of your charter. That's the limitations of your Social Security agreement. Now, your powers, Joe, once you have the Social Security number, or you, if you've created a corporation, your corporate powers are limited by law. Corporations can make no contracts not authorized by its charter. Now, take a look at this, Joe. Let's suppose you want to go to work without a hard hat and steel-toed shoes, and you want to work for less than minimum wage. Oh, no, Joe. No. You're going to be fired from off the job. You see, you've got a contract with your employer and the United States government, the state, and the Social Security, the Department of Labor. You know, there's a lot of agencies that are involved in your contract, and they all agree that you have to wear a hard hat, steel-toed shoes, work for minimum wage. That's why we have wage and hour laws, and you follow all those wage and hour laws. You don't have any right or capacity to shed any of those laws. They're called protections, and you have to take them whether you want them or not. So the corporation's rights to act as a corporation are only preserved to it so long as it obeys the laws of its creator. And there's a reserved right in the legislature to investigate its contracts and to find out whether it's exceeded its powers. And that's why, Joe, when the IRS says, we want you to come in here and produce your records and books, you don't have any Fourth Amendment right to refuse to submit those books and records, which later can be used against you in the event that you haven't followed all of these thousands of rules and regulations under the Title 26 tax code. God, isn't that just kind of neat? Now listen, let me turn over here to a few letters from Social Security. See, when you write a letter to the Social Security Administration and you rescind your Social Security number or your Social Security account, you'll receive a form letter back. Not everybody gets a form letter back. I didn't when I rescinded mine, but a lot of my students have over the years, and they have shared them with me. So here's one from one of my students from the Commissioner of Social Security. And it says, every worker is free to choose employment that is not covered by Social Security. Isn't that kind of neat? Now, you're probably sitting there saying, I cannot imagine a single job or a classification of employment in America that isn't covered by Social Security. Well, I can. In fact, the thing that makes your job covered by Social Security is whether or not you're acting in public business and whether or not you have a public contract. Now, I'm George Gordon, and I operate a private law school, and I don't have a Social Security number, and my law school is not covered by Social Security. I'm not entitled to the benefit, and this school is not open to the public. It is by invitation only, and it's private. And that's the difference between opening a school like the University of Missouri. Whereas if I was working at the University of Missouri, which has a contract with the government, and all of their employees are in covered employment, and if I want to work there, then I have to have a Social Security number, but I don't have to work there at the University of Missouri. If I did, I'd have to pay income tax and Social Security. So I said, well, I don't want to pay that. I don't want to be subject to wage and hour laws. I want to have rights, freedoms, and I want to be independent. In order to do that, I have to get into an area that is not covered by Social Security. So not every teacher in America is covered by Social Security, although most are. Now, Social Security, here's the second letter. Social Security is a voluntary system in that no one is required to get a number. Now, this is on Social Security. Social Security letterhead, and in my tax and status school, we're on chapter 21. Now, there's 46 lessons in my tax school, 46 things that you need to know about the income tax, and in order for you to make wise choices, choices that will determine whether or not you give up Social Security or you keep it. I'm not here to tell you that you shouldn't have Social Security or that you shouldn't pay your income tax or that you should quit your job and go do something like I'm doing. I just open a school and give information and show you where the laws are, like Social Security is located at Title 42, Section 301 through 335, so that you can make a choice. Notice this, that no person, or however, a person with no Social Security number would have no taxable income. This is from Social Security. A person with no Social Security number would have no taxable income. And there's no law requiring a person to apply for a Social Security number, and there's no section of Title 18 of the U.S. Code making it a crime not to have a Social Security number. Now, here's a kicker. You'll love this one. This actually doesn't come from the Social Security Administration. It comes from Stewart versus Chinese Chamber of Commerce, cited at 168 Fed 2nd 709 on page 712. Listen to this. The revenue laws are a code or system in regulation of tax assessment and collection. They relate to taxpayers and not to non-taxpayers. And no procedure is prescribed for non-taxpayers, and no attempt is made to annul any of their rights and remedies in due course of law. With them, Congress does not assume to deal, and they're neither of the subject nor of the object of the revenue laws. Taxpayers and non-taxpayers recognized by Congress here in Stewart versus Chinese Chamber of Commerce. Now, if you'd like to learn more about the income tax, and if you'd like to drop out of the income tax system, I'm more than happy to show you how to do that, but don't think for a moment now that you can do that just by making an announcement that I'm no longer a taxpayer. You know, people have been doing that for a long time, and they go to jail when they do. So remember the telephone number here at the law school, 417-273-4967. That's area code 417-273-4967. If you want more information, go to my webpage, georgegordon.com. That's georgegordon.com. And if you'd like, just click onto the email machine, send me an email request, and we'd be more than happy to talk to you about our tax and status schools, give you a calendar, and tell you when the next school is going to be. All right, let's take a break here, and we'll come right back, and we'll take up this thing of courtroom strategy and procedure, because, you know, if you're going to drop out of the tax system, you might end up in federal court. And if you do, what are you going to tell the judge when he asks the question, how come you're not filing and paying your income tax, Joe? Hang on.